me whenever the word was used incorrectly in a meeting, an eyebrow slightly raised. Sitting down with the reporters, Brennan made the case that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda had to be viewed separately, arguing that when the two are aligned, it's mainly on the tactical front. He stressed that we needed to destroy Al-Qaeda, but that it wasn't necessary to destroy the Taliban to accomplish this goal. The Taliban had to be pushed back to give us the capacity to go after Al-Qaeda, but we couldn't destroy a movement indigenous to Afghanistan's tribes with local agendas that did not include launching attacks against the United States beyond Afghanistan's borders. When the session was over, I felt we were finally beginning to get our message out, laying a predicate for a less ambitious commitment in Afghanistan. But when the story came out, with the headline, "Afghan War Debate Now Leans to Focus on Al-Qaeda," I felt I was playing out of my league. Going to the press, especially the Times, was a blunt instrument, and the story could have come only from the White House, given the view it reflected. The Pentagon was a large building, staffed with thousands of people, so leaks could be blamed on an anonymous multitude. The White House was small, and the number of people who knew what was going on in the Afghan review numbered fewer than 20. I knew people were unlikely to blame Obama, or even more senior aides like Brennan. It's always easier to blame the younger guy. I got a chilly phone call from Gates's press secretary, counseling me that people in his building were upset with the story. Gates met privately with Obama to say that he was furious. This was no way to conduct a review. Obama expressed no concern to me about the story, but he wanted to keep Gates happy, so in the next meeting he made a point of saying that he didn't want to read any more about the deliberations in the newspaper. To me, the hypocrisy was stinging. The whole review had been shaped by leaks from the military designed to box Obama into sending more troops into Afghanistan. I kept reading anecdotes in the press about how much Gates hated leaks, when nearly all of them emanated from his department. I knew that Admiral Mike Mullen, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and General Petraeus shared an independent communications advisor who seemed to spend much of the day in casual conversations, meals, and drinks with reporters, something that I didn't have the time to do. I thought about Axe's comment. Maybe I wasn't up for this kind of thing. In meeting after meeting, the principals seemed to calibrate their arguments to align with Obama's views without changing their position on troops. Gates argued that he wasn't for a CT strategy or a full coin strategy. He was for something in between, something that promoted a strong, effective government that delivers services to the people. When the shortcomings of the Afghan government were pointed out, Gates said that we should not give $1 or soldier for a corrupt government, even though that's exactly what we were doing. Petraeus said our goal was not to defeat the Taliban, but to deny them population centers. Mullen talked about the psychological piece, the need to create the impression that the Taliban will lose. For the same reason, Clinton said that putting in troops wouldn't work, but you still need to put in troops. It seemed to sum things up perfectly. We had created political pressure on ourselves to send in troops based on a theory of coin. The review was determining that coin couldn't succeed. But all of the arguments still pointed to sending in the same number of troops. "We are not going to defeat the Taliban," Obama kept saying. "We need to knock them back to give us space to go after Al-Qaeda." As the review ground on, the public pressure on Obama shifted from making the case for more troops to something more primal, a criticism that would persist for 7 years. He was, Washington concluded, dithering. Nothing bothered Obama more than one column by David Brooks in the New York Times. Brooks, a temperamentally moderate guy, announced that he had spoken to the nation's smartest military experts, people who follow the war for a living, who spend their days in military circles both here and in Afghanistan. These people, according to Brooks, are not worried about his policy choices. Their first concerns are more fundamental. They are worried about his determination. As if that wasn't clear enough, their concerns are about Obama the man. Brooks gave the assurance that most of them, like most people who have spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, believe this war is winnable, though he didn't describe what winning looked like. He concluded that for Obama, the most important meeting isn't with the Joint Chiefs and Cabinet Secretaries. It's the one with the mirror. "Why is this whole thing being framed around whether I have any balls?" Obama asked a small group of us in the Oval. He had begun to call us up there every now and then to recap what had gone on in the meetings downstairs. "I think it's clear I care about Afghanistan, because I'm spending all this time trying to get it right." We nodded in agreement. As would often be the case, he vented about things that he could not really change, the structural dynamic in Washington that sees politics as a game and foreign policy as an extension of politics. Turning serious, he reiterated that he was willing to send in more troops, he told us, but he was worried about sustainability. The chart that the military used to plot the troop requests showed our commitment to Afghanistan going up to about 100,000 troops over the next 2 years, and then staying there indefinitely. McChrystal assessed that we would need a substantial force for 4 years until the Afghan security forces would be able to take the lead. Meanwhile, Eikenberry was arguing that the Afghan government would never get its act together if it felt as if we were going to be staying forever. "This is going to cost a lot of money and a lot of lives," Obama said, kicking off one of the final Situation Room meetings. "Am I going to see kids who had their legs blown off at Walter Reed and Bethesda in 8 years?" The room was quiet. He held up the chart showing the 40,000 troops sent into Afghanistan and staying there, a line that hit a plateau, a line that represented lives forever changed. "You keep giving me the same option," he said. "I can't sell this. It will be 6 years until we're essentially back to where we are now." Speaking as the only one who had to think about everything the U.S. government has to do around the world, he said, "A 6 to 8 year war at over $50 billion a year is not in the national interest. The Petraeus surge in Iraq was much quicker than that. This has to be a surge like that." Biden chimed in. "That's goddamn right." He argued that we should put in no more than the smallest force necessary to do counterterrorism, no more than 10,000 troops. Obama asked each of the principals for their final recommendation, and one by one they endorsed McChrystal's troop request. Clinton said we needed to show resolve and act like we're going to win. Gates supported the recommendation, while agreeing with Obama that the military would need clear timelines, a concession to Obama's view. Mullen gave his strong endorsement, adding that by mid-2011 we'd either be winning or losing. Petraeus, the intellectual architect of the approach, simply said that he agreed with Gates, Clinton, and Mullen. Brennan gave the best summary of what we ended up doing. He noted that we'd have to sustain our ability to go after al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan and train Afghan security forces, all of which required more troops for some time. But he noted that it would take at least a generation to transform Afghanistan, and that we needed to stick to more modest goals. I said nothing. Obama said he'd think about it. He told me to get started on the outline of a speech. On Thanksgiving, I sat in my dad's home office, which had once been my childhood bedroom, and started to work on it as my family watched football in the other room. While my parents were filled with pride at my new position, giving toasts over dinner to the health of the President of the United States, my mind was far away, on the computer screen that held a barely begun speech, and I had no idea how to explain to them what it was I'd been doing. Instead, I wanted to talk about anything else. The next day, I was back at work. Obama called me up to the Oval Office. It was just the two of us, standing near the door, and he asked me what I thought he should do. In the short silence that followed, I felt the full weight of his question. For weeks, I'd sat along the back bench, filled with opinions about what was being said. Now, a man with the authority to send troops to fight a war was asking me what I thought. I was hesitant. I was too new at this. I had a sense of which arguments held together best, but I didn't feel it was possible for me to predict what was going to take place in Afghanistan. I agree with Brennan, I finally said. You need a surge to push back the Taliban, but the goal should be to target Al-Qaeda, train the Afghans, and then have a transition. I was describing how we would articulate the strategy more than I was making a recommendation. I then started to make arguments back to Obama that he'd made downstairs. I wasn't adding a lot of value. Target, train, transfer, Obama said. I could tell that he was trying out a catchphrase, one he might use to sell the escalation of this war as something less than the coin strategy that he had rejected in his mind. Ultimately, Obama decided to send 30,000 American troops to Afghanistan, with NATO getting us the rest of the way to 40,000. We would announce it as a temporary surge. In 18 months, the troops would start to draw down. We'd secure Afghanistan's major population centers, then shift to training and counterterrorism, essentially endorsing the Petraeus-McChrystal approach for 2 years, and then shifting to the Biden-Brennan approach sooner than the military wanted. At Biden's suggestion, Obama had all the principals memorialize their agreement with the plan in writing. It felt like a bit much, but this was the lesson from Vietnam. Limit escalation. The next day, we met to go over his speech. The tone, he said, should be sober and adult, not depressing. He sat next to me on the couch and began to talk, not so much about the speech, but about the kind of president he wanted to be. The American people are idealists, he said, but their leaders have to be realistic and hard-headed. At the beginning and end of the speech, he wanted to draw upon American idealism, Roosevelt's belief that we carry special burdens in the world. In between, he wanted to acknowledge that in disorderly places there is a limit to what we can achieve. When he was finished, he went back behind his desk and sat down. I stood there an extra moment. I'd watched him get pushed into a corner that fall and stay there. I'd seen him try to slow the momentum that was leading inexorably to more troops, more war. I'd watched as that process became, essentially, a negotiation between the far-reaching recommendations of his advisors and his own sense of realism. At the same time, the economy was teetering on a ledge between depression and slow recovery, and an overhaul of American health care was creeping through Congress. The American public was exhausted by nearly a decade of war. In a way, we'd failed him by making him spend so much time on this review. He'd reshaped what had come to him and turned it into something that he felt was necessary, something worthy of sacrifice, something with limits. But I could still sense his unease at sending young people to die. I'm proud to work for you, I said. It felt a bit awkward, as though I was overstepping a boundary with a man who tended to keep his emotions at a distance. I just wanted to say that. I was trying to sum up something, to convey that I saw how lonely his job must be, and perhaps to say something about how this experience was changing me, how I'd try to do better. It would be the only time I ever told him that. He looked up at me. I appreciate you, he said. Get to work. In the coming days, he consistently took out of the speech any language that spoke of winning or victory. He would pay tribute to the troops, but not overpromise. We should glorify their service, he told me, but we should not glorify war. Years later, Gates, the most important advisor in the process, would say that Obama's strategy was right, but he was not sufficiently committed to the mission, a convenient way for Gates to argue that he was right, and any problems in Afghanistan were Obama's. But that was wrong. Obama was committed to taking out Al-Qaeda. That was just not as ambitious a mission as what the military had in mind. He gave the speech on December 1st at West Point. I stood backstage with him as rows and rows of uniformed soldiers awaited his words. Some of them would end up dying as a result of the decision Obama was announcing. Before going out, Obama fidgeted a bit backstage, waiting as a large clock ticked down to the moment when he would stride out onto the stage to deliver the address. "They're so young," he said. A week after escalating the war in Afghanistan, Obama flew to Oslo to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. To help him prepare the remarks he'd give at the ceremony, Obama had asked Jon Favreau and me to give him a selection of speeches and essays about war. John F. Kennedy speaking about the nature of peace and calling for a nuclear test ban treaty. Churchill, Roosevelt, and Lincoln at war. Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., and Reinhold Niebuhr. The two of us sat together and drafted a speech that mainly dealt with the tension of his getting the award at the beginning of his presidency. We sent it to Obama and heard nothing back until 10 on the morning we were going to board the plane for Oslo. He called us up to the Oval Office, along with Samantha Power. Without our knowing, she'd sent Obama a memo laying out sweeping ambitions for the speech, which she saw as a chance to address fundamental issues of war and peace. He looked tired and a little annoyed. "I had to stay up all night writing this," he said, handing us 7 pages torn from a yellow legal pad, each filled with his tiny, neat handwriting. The only other time he had written a speech from scratch was during the campaign, when he delivered his address on race. For the next several hours, I sat at my desk typing up his writing, polishing it in places, dividing up sections with Favreau. Obama had turned the entire speech into an effort to deal with the tension of getting the award right after he had decided to send 30,000 troops to fight in a war. Samantha's memo, together with the Afghan review, had stirred something inside him. I started to circulate the draft, which was dotted with quotes from Niebuhr. Meditations on the meaning of war, and personal language reconciling his current position with his political heritage. As someone who stands here as a direct consequence of Dr. King's life work, I am living testimony to the moral force of nonviolence. I know there's nothing weak, nothing passive, nothing naive in the creed of the lives of Gandhi and King. But as a head of state, sworn to protect and defend my nation, I cannot be guided by their examples alone. For the first time, I boarded Marine One with him and Michelle Obama because I needed extra time to work on the draft. The helicopter flew over downtown D.C. at dusk. There was the Washington Monument from above, the Lincoln Memorial in the distance. I tried to disappear into the couch that faced the two of them while Michelle chided me a bit. "He was up most of the night," she said, in what felt a little like a rebuke. I know," I said. We flew all night and none of us slept. Obama read over revisions a page at a time in his office. I worked on the oversized computer in the back. Favreau and Power made edits in the conference room. The speech broke down into a simple structure that anticipated so many of the debates we'd have in the years to come. The first part, a description of when war is just. The second, a description of how we must pursue peace, including a commitment to diplomacy. "I know engagement with repressive regimes lacks the satisfying purity of indignation. But I also know that sanctions without outreach, condemnation without discussion, can carry forward only a crippling status quo." Finally, we told him to get an hour of sleep before we landed. When we got to the hotel, we went to a makeshift staff office to finish the speech. Samantha had been focused on the section that laid out the case for when it is just to fight a war. Obama had defended the traditional concept of the use of force in self-defense. In other cases, he said, war had to meet certain international standards, such as the enforcement of international law. These were the cases in which, Obama had written, eerily foreshadowing Syria, "More and more we all confront difficult questions about how to prevent the slaughter of civilians by their own government, or to stop a civil war whose violence and suffering can engulf an entire region." Samantha wanted to insert the concept of nations having a responsibility to protect, saying that if governments commit atrocities, nations were justified, if not obliged, to intervene. This would have represented a significant new policy for the United States, which Samantha knew. "Think of the message this will send," she kept saying. I didn't know if Obama wanted to go that far. He was in his hotel room getting ready. It was morning in Oslo, the middle of the night in D.C., and Samantha and I sat there arguing this point while I squinted at Obama's last edits. I felt I needed to get another opinion so I wouldn't be the only one making this decision. I called Dennis McDonough, who never seemed to sleep. He felt strongly that we couldn't include a commitment of that significance without running it through a formal process in the government. I went to meet Obama outside his suite, where he had some final edits. I summarized the debate I'd been having with Samantha, and he looked at me with exasperation. "I'm on my way to deliver the speech," he said. "This isn't the time to be making policy." John and I made his final edits, language that spoke of the tension between the world as it is and our effort to strive for the world that ought to be. In March 2010, Obama made his first visit to Afghanistan as president. We had to travel in secret. On our descent, all the lights on Air Force One were shut off to avoid offering a target. We boarded helicopters at Bagram Airfield and flew into Kabul. All I saw was a scattering of lights in the rolling hills beyond, like reflections of moonlight on a rippling lake. The presidential palace was a tranquil complex of buildings with internal courtyards, full of fountains and winding pathways. While Obama met with Karzai, I smoked and made small talk with some of the guys who formed McChrystal's inner circle. Like so many of the troops I met in government, they represented the ethos of a post-9/11 generation that had been asked to bear so many more responsibilities than the rest of the American people, while being given complex missions in challenging places. They were smart, tough, and mission-oriented, without the luxury of questioning the mission. We flew back to Bagram, and Obama spoke to a cheering throng of uniformed service members. All told, we were on the ground for only a few hours, VIP visitors escorted within a security bubble in Kabul, far from where the fighting was taking place, out in the sprawling darkness. A few weeks later, Karzai came to Washington, and McChrystal's team invited me out to his house at Fort McNair, a handsome multi-story home with a backyard. We stood drinking Bud Light Limes out of a trash can filled with ice. McChrystal had an easy camaraderie with the people around him. They struck me as decent guys doing their best in a difficult spot, as confused at how to navigate Washington as I had been when I took my job. I was surprised at how openly they complained about the Pentagon, which I hadn't yet heard from service members. Each agency, I was learning, had its own layer of bureaucracy and rivalry. Later that night, Anne and I went out to dinner with one of McChrystal's closest aides, Dave Silverman. We were at a tapas restaurant in downtown D.C., about as far away from Afghanistan as you can get. We agreed to keep in touch, and Anne and I talked on the way home about how we could see ourselves striking up a lasting friendship. It wasn't to be. Not much later, a story came out in Rolling Stone that depicted McChrystal and his team as an out-of-control boys' club, speaking crudely of just about everyone involved in Afghanistan policy. Littered with quotable put-downs of everyone from Biden, "Are you asking about Vice President Biden? Who's that?" to Holbrooke. "Oh, not another email from Holbrooke. I don't even want to open it." It ignited a firestorm. I had to reach out to Silverman that night and tell him that Obama wanted McChrystal to come home for consultations. He was surprised. They knew it was bad, but from the distance of Afghanistan, where McChrystal was the most powerful human being, it seemed to them like a passing storm. That night, I met Obama on the patio outside the Oval Office. He asked me to write two speeches for the next day, one in which he'd decided to keep McChrystal for the sake of continuity, and one in which he'd decided to fire him to enforce the principles of civilian control of the military. He didn't tell me what his decision would be, But he tipped his hand when he spent a lot more time giving guidance for a decision to get rid of McChrystal. He seemed more sad than angry. "Stan's a good guy," he said. I woke to emails from Silverman about how contrite the team was and about how McChrystal was an honorable man who had learned his lesson. I didn't doubt him. McChrystal believed deeply in what he was doing, even if I had my doubts about the wisdom of Coyne in Afghanistan. But no private could talk about a captain the way McChrystal and his team talked about their chain of command in the story, and why was a general even talking to Rolling Stone in the first place? It was a sign of how out of whack things had gotten in the post-9/11 wars, in which the glorification of Petraeus suggested that the way for a general to get ahead was to have independent lines to Congress and the media. It was also an outgrowth of how the entire Afghan review had unfolded, with Obama's views being secondary to those of the military officers who reported to him. That morning, Obama called a few of us into the Oval Office. He said he was reluctant to fire McChrystal, but he would never be able to exert civilian control over the military if he didn't. After I left the meeting, I walked down the hallway and past the Roosevelt Room. I saw McChrystal standing there, waiting for his meeting with Obama, looking nervous and somewhat diminished. Not the commanding figure who had seized control over the debate about Afghanistan policy back in the fall. After the announcement, Obama convened his national security team, the same personalities who had proved so hard to manage during the Afghan review. It was a brief meeting, and he raised his voice, which almost never happened. "If people can't pull together as a team, then other people are going to go. I mean it." As he walked down the hallway afterward, he turned to me. "It's too bad," he said. "I really did like Stan." A year later, he would announce the beginning of a drawdown of American troops from Afghanistan. On schedule. Chapter 8. The End of the Beginning. Here is what my life was like during the first year after I took my new job. Sometimes the phone would ring in the middle of the night. 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. I'd pick it up and hear, "This is the White House Situation Room calling for Mr. Rhodes," followed by news of some calamity, a natural disaster, an attempted coup, a car bombing in Afghanistan. I'd stare at my BlackBerry, waiting to see if any more news emerged. Anne would ask me what was going on, and I'd tell her. "What do they want you to do about it at 2 in the morning, she'd say. I'd email people I knew who worked at the embassy in the affected area to make sure they were all right. If I felt we needed to release a statement, I'd email a few people to get a draft started. Then I'd lie in bed, imagining what it was like to be there, where the protest was massing or the truck bomb went off, to get the same phone call I got, only it was to tell you your wife or brother had been killed. I knew the bad news before everyone else. I'd lie awake for as long as it took for my mind to shut back down so I could drift to sleep. I'd wake up between 6 and 7. Each morning, an appointed White House media monitor would send a list of news stories to a large group of staff, anything having to do with Obama, or to a smaller list, national security. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Wires, AP, Reuters, Bloomberg, AFP, then Politico, USA Today, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Congressional Dailies, the Hill, Roll Call, an assortment of right-wing media, Fox News, the New York Post, the Daily Caller, Breitbart, transcripts from the various television morning shows, longer magazine pieces, and in later years, notable tweets. This is how I got my news for 10 years, by scrolling through my BlackBerry, reading different versions of the same story, looking for a shift in the narrative about Obama or our foreign policy, for what might raise an international issue that was escaping attention, for what lines of attack Republican critics were repeating in ways that might signal a new, coordinated effort, to keep Gitmo open, to bomb somebody, to portray Obama as un-American. I could tell they were getting traction if I also got emails from reporters cutting and pasting a quote from a Republican critic and asking if I had a response. This was Washington presenting a constant choice. Ignore something and let it stand, or feed it oxygen by hitting back. I'd shower and shave listening to NPR, the calmest minutes of my day, and head out the door around 8, walking to the bus stop on Connecticut Avenue. I'd stand on the bus for the 10-minute ride, scanning the last of the clips on my BlackBerry and seeing what emails from my colleagues might set the tone for the day. I'd get off the bus at 17th and I, where armies of lawyers and lobbyists made their way to soulless 8-story office buildings, and walk south among a dwindling group of people making their way to the White House. I'd flash my blue White House badge at a Secret Service gate where foreign tourists sometimes argued with agents in broken English because they thought they could enter there for a White House tour. Entering the West Wing, I'd grab a coffee from the White House mess carryout window and be trailed back to my office by a briefer, someone from the intelligence community who would sit across from my desk and walk me through the president's daily briefing, PDB. In those days, before we switched to iPads, the PDB was a mahogany leather binder with the seal of the president on it. The first few items, referred to as articles, were 1- or 2-page summaries of key topics or developments that would also go to Obama. Usually, they dealt with whatever bad thing around the world merited his attention. Terrorism, a worrisome trend in the Middle East, a new development with China or Russia. I was always struck by the exclusion of large global trends, climate, governance, food, health, in favor of an intricate level of detail about terrorist plots. After 9/11, the intelligence community was going to let any president know anything it knew about a potential plot, even if there was little he could do about it. The briefer watched me as I read the material while offering additional color. These people had been up all night. They would meet in the early morning hours with the analysts who drafted the PDB articles to get additional context so they'd be ready for queries from people like me. I always felt compelled to ask questions, even when I didn't have any, because they worked so hard to be prepared. In addition to the PDB articles, they'd include a packet of intelligence reports, a tiny sample of the enormous volume of information collected by the U.S. government, that were relevant to topics that were a focus for the White House. They called this traffic. When I finished this briefing, I'd open my email and usually find Politico Playbook there, a tip sheet emailed to a few thousand people in media and government. I never subscribed to it, I just started getting it in my inbox one morning around the election. It attempted to distill the news into what people needed to know. What were the storylines driving political coverage and debate? What D.C. insider had a birthday? Ari Fleischer is 57. Who was out the previous night? Spotted at Bobby Vann's. It portrayed American politics as a game played by a few thousand insiders who mainly cared about who was up and who was down in the daily narrative. Yet, to fulfill my responsibilities as a national security and communications official, I had to be familiar with the contents of both the PDB and Playbook. This hit home for me over Christmas in 2009. We were sitting around the tree in my parents' living room when I got a call. This is the White House Situation Room calling for Mr. Rhodes. A young Nigerian named Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab had tried to set his underwear on fire on a flight to Detroit. His underwear contained explosives. They didn't ignite. When the plane landed, he was arrested, taken into custody, and questioned. Was anyone hurt? I asked. No. Was this part of a broader plot? No. Was there a claim of responsibility from a terrorist group? Not yet. Then American politics and media took over. A few days later, I'd opened my playbook to this headline. Briefs bomber may disrupt plans to empty Gitmo. Test of leadership for Hawaiian White House. Cerebral or slow? GOP plans to keep hitting Dems on terrorism. Invasion of the body scanners. And then this analysis. Good Tuesday morning. The White House gets harsh reviews for its handling of the briefs bomber aftermath, with the lead headline of the New York Times saying of the president's remarks yesterday, moves to quell critics. Peter Baker's Honolulu dispatch begins, President Obama emerged from Hawaiian seclusion. A Yunji Denise piece on GMA showed clip after clip of the White House response being attacked on cable news, mostly by Republicans, and made a big deal of the president's golfing and even playing a game of tennis before his public address. I spent a few days earnestly telling reporters that we didn't want to overreact, but this approach was dismissed as cerebral. After a few days of hysteria, Al-Qaeda's affiliate in Yemen claimed responsibility for the attack and grew in prestige because they had successfully terrorized America. Democratic support for closing Gitmo plummeted simply because Republicans were on television asserting that Obama was weak and terrorists like Abdul Muttalib should be sent to a military prison. Part of me wanted to ignore this side of my job. I wanted to read intelligence reports, go to policy meetings, write speeches that I hoped the world understood. But that wasn't an option. Later in the morning, I'd prepare for the daily press briefings out of the State Department, the Pentagon, and the White House. We'd hold conference calls with the spokespeople at different agencies to go over the key news items of the day and what we were going to say about them. Then I'd join the several staffers in the NSC press office, most of them Foreign Service Officers, FSOs, who worked for a year or two at the NSC, to walk Robert Gibbs through the questions he was likely to get in his White House press briefings. These FSOs were around my age, people who'd signed up after 9/11 and served at embassies across the Middle East and around the world. They were acutely aware of how foreign publics consumed the words that came out of the United States government, of where we could make an impact and where we couldn't. When the briefings were done, I'd eat lunch at my desk and catch up on emails. The early afternoon was usually filled with a deputies' committee meeting in which the deputy-level officials from various agencies, state, defense, the intelligence community, and treasury, come together to make policy on different issues. These meetings were always in the Situation Room and usually ran a couple of hours. Each agency would present its view, the meeting evolving toward some kind of consensus that could make its way up to the cabinet-level officials and, if necessary, Obama. At first, I felt intimidated at being included in these groups. But I had a clear equity. How would these policies be received publicly at home and abroad? How would we explain them, and how should we take that into account as we made policy? I also came to see that people assumed I knew or could anticipate what Obama would think on an issue. In the absence of international crises throughout 2010, these meetings and our foreign policy focused largely on methodically advancing a few issues: implementing the Afghanistan strategy, withdrawing troops from Iraq, negotiating a new START arms control treaty with Russia, imposing sanctions on Iran. But 2010 would be the last year when foreign policy felt somewhat routine. Those meetings would become far more consequential soon enough. In many ways, my job that year was to help keep things calm on our accounts while Obama pursued his domestic agenda, particularly health care. The night that the Affordable Care Act passed Congress, Obama had a small group of us up to the White House residence to celebrate. He looked as if a weight had been lifted off his shoulders as he hoisted a martini glass on the Truman balcony and told us, "This is what we all came here to do. This." Standing there, I realized everyone in the White House supported the totality of his agenda, not just our pieces. In the late afternoon, between 5 and 7, I would usually focus on planning for whatever the next big item was on the calendar, the next speech, the next major policy rollout, the next foreign trip. This part of my job grew in the fall when Donilon replaced Jones as National Security Advisor, with Dennis McDonough moving up to the lead Deputy National Security Advisor role. This left the role of NSC Chief of Staff vacant for several months, leaving me the responsibility of planning Obama's schedule, what foreign countries he'd visit, who he'd meet with there, a responsibility I'd hold for the rest of the administration. Foreign trips were my favorite part of the job. You got to immerse yourself in a different place for a period of time. Its politics, how it fit into U.S. foreign policy, what its people cared about. Strange things happened. In Russia, I came back to my room from the staff office to find a cleaning woman standing next to the bed and three men in suits going through my things. They put everything down and walked out without a word. You saw the impact Obama had on certain audiences. In Ghana, it seemed every television channel was playing a documentary about his life, and the radio was filled with people singing his name. Barack Obama. You are our Obama. Speeches that he gave abroad got little attention at home, but would be carefully consumed in the places where he gave them for years. At the end of the day, between 8 and 9, I'd come home and eat dinner with Anne and watch some television. Before going to sleep, I'd check a last round of emails close to midnight. There was always some loose end to be tied up, some question to answer. Then I'd drift to sleep, playing over the day in my head, thinking about what I had to do when I woke up. That November, as we were preparing to go to Asia, an enormous electoral wave gave the Republican Party control of the House of Representatives, a stinging repudiation of a 2-year period in which Obama saved the global economy, passed a $1 trillion stimulus, reformed financial regulations, and passed health care legislation. We expected to lose, but not as badly as we did. Our people had stayed home, and Palin's had turned out. In the days after the election, I had come into the Oval Office and caught the tail end of conversations in which Obama was calling a member of Congress who'd lost the election because of their health care vote, thanking them for making a difference. When you show up as Barack Obama in India or Indonesia, no one there cares about the midterm results. This created a strange discordance between the somber bubble we traveled within and the enthusiasm outside it. I packed the schedule. Barack and Michelle Obama dancing with schoolchildren in Mumbai. Obama holding a town hall meeting with students. The first African-American president paying tribute to Mahatma Gandhi in Delhi. Obama, the man who lived in Indonesia as a child, delighting a crowd with phrases in Indonesian. Those were always my favorite moments on trips. Moments that connect a president to people in other countries, when people didn't just see Obama, but felt seen by him. I thought the trip was going great, but he was tired and increasingly cranky. Much of our press was waiting to write that the world was souring on Obama, just like the electorate back home. Things started to fall apart in Seoul on the 5th day when we attended the G20. We missed a deadline to complete the renegotiation of a free trade agreement with South Korea, and the trip quickly turned into a story about Obama's diminished star. Before a press conference, Gibbs, Jen Psaki, and I walked into a conference room to brief him. Psaki was kind, curious, and unflappable, with bright red hair, a permanent smile, and a maternal instinct for her colleagues. She had started in Chicago around the same time as I did, and over the years, she became like a sister within our surrogate Obama family. Obama was sitting with his top economic advisors, and they had been complaining about the lack of credit they were getting for rescuing the global economy from a depression. Gibbs, Psaki, and I quickly became the object of blame for how the press covered foreign policy and, by extension, our politics back home. "Does anyone in the press even care that we're responsible for every word in this communique?" Obama said, holding up a sheet of paper, the carefully negotiated text that the G20 would issue upon completion of the summit. In reality, the answer was no. It was hard for me to care about the communique. I avoided making eye contact with Psaki because I would have laughed. His G20 frustration was clearly a proxy for everything else. The midterms, the press, the sense that he'd been handed as bad an inheritance as any president since Roosevelt, and no one cared. By this point, I'd learned that Obama got mad only at the people closest to him. With everyone else, he was unfailingly polite. By the time we got to Japan, I was the only one around when he wanted someone to complain at. He called me up to his suite, one of dozens of such rooms that I'd see him in over the years, all eerily familiar in their uncomfortable opulence. He had all the newspapers laid out on a table by the door, their headlines a Greek chorus of ridicule. He gestured at them, a scowl on his face, sarcasm in his voice. "Isn't there something we can do about this?" Feeling tired myself, I snapped back. "No, not when we don't actually reach a trade agreement." He moved on to the next thing, preparing for the APEC summit, as if that very fact encapsulated the absurdity of being president and never getting a break. Remind me why this organization even exists. With that, I started to laugh, and so did he, as a group of APEC policy experts walked into the room looking confused. I felt the same frustration he did at the venal politics at home. But I was also upset at him. I'd spent months planning a trip that would appeal to each of these countries, India, Indonesia, South Korea, and Japan. Countries that accounted for 1.5 billion people with distinctive governments, interests, and populations. India, the home of his hero, Gandhi. Indonesia, his home as a boy. Often, I felt as though I cared more about the global progressive icon Barack Obama than Barack Obama did. The next and final day, we went to see a giant Japanese Buddha that Obama had visited as a child. We'd picked the site knowing that it would strike a chord in a Japanese culture that loved Obama and this type of recognition. He was quiet on the ride out as the helicopter flew over brilliant green hills and a winding coastline. The motorcade then drove for miles on twisting roads through small fishing villages lined with people, thousands of people smiling and waving. Even for Obama, the crowds were extraordinary. A kindly older Japanese woman then showed Obama around the 12th century Buddha, an austere stone monument that put midterm elections in perspective. When we got back to the helicopter, he looked out the window for a few minutes. Then he looked at me and said, "That was good to do." "It will be the biggest story here in Japan," I said. "I know. I know why you make me do all of this stuff on trips," he said. "It matters to a lot of people." We rode on in silence. That December, I traveled with Obama to Hawaii as the lone NSC staffer who would be there during his Christmas vacation. As soon as Air Force One took off, I felt a sense of relief. We'd been through 2 years of the campaign, then 2 years in the White House. We'd proved to ourselves that we belonged, suffered a drubbing in the midterms, and then bounced back, ramming the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the ramification of the New START Treaty through Congress. Gay people could now serve openly in the military, and the United States and Russia would be pointing fewer nuclear weapons at each other. We had learned that a White House on its back foot can still accomplish more than just about any other institution in the world. The staff was put up at a hotel in Waikiki, and I had a balcony that looked out over the Pacific Ocean. There was a soothing rhythm to the days, waking up at 5 to put together a memo for Obama on what was happening around the world, reading books not related to work, driving to the northern shore of Oahu, taking in the surfers, shrimp trucks, and small bungalows, and coming to understand why someone could find his own little piece of the world here and never go back. But there was a lonesome tinge to the experience. Anne was with her family in California before flying out to Hawaii for the second half of the trip. So on Christmas Day, I walked through groups of people on the beach, away from friends and family for the first time in my life. That night, one of the advanced staffers put together a small party in one of the basement conference rooms of the hotel. I went for a little bit, mingling with an odd assortment of staffers, and then left to sit up on my balcony. Another hotel, one of hundreds. I had gained a new life that brought me to this beautiful place with a president, but I'd lost my old one as well. I called Anne and then my parents, and could hear the background noise of more familiar holiday experiences that were now distant. As the sun set into the Pacific, I listened to the voices of strangers wafting up to the balcony and thought about my family and friends. I'd become somebody they watched from afar, whose quotes they might read in the newspaper more often than they spoke to me, someone whose experiences were unknowable to them. A few days later, Obama invited a few of us to go snorkeling at Hanama Bay. I drove there with Anne in a rental car, parked, and then we walked over a hill. Down below lay a curving, pristine beach that opens out onto the bay, a reef glistening in the sun. Normally, thousands of people might pass through here on a given day, but one day a week it's closed, and they let the Obamas use it. The Secret Service had shut down a perimeter surrounding the beach, and casually dressed agents stood on the tops of the tall rock formations that overlooked us. The beach was dotted with only the Obama family, their friends, and a handful of staff. I'd never snorkeled before, and after I got over the awkwardness of it, I allowed myself to forget the world beyond whatever was in the water beneath me. When I walked back up onto the beach, I saw Obama headed toward me, looking even thinner than usual without a shirt on. He stood next to me, and we looked out at the water. "This doesn't suck," I said. He pointed up to a place at the top of the hill that looked over the scene. "You see that spot up there?" he said. "My mom used to come here every day and sit there looking out at the bay when she was pregnant with me." I could hear waves lapping at the shore. "I've always thought that's one of the reasons why I have a certain calm." For a moment, the entire world seemed to quiet. This calm belied a gathering storm. Just a few days earlier, a small story had popped up on my BlackBerry, one of millions of stories that happen every day, most of which lead to nothing beyond the confines of their community. A fruit cart vendor in Tunisia, Mohamed Bouazizi, had grown frustrated by the harassment he faced from corrupt officials and set himself on fire, initiating protests in the small North African nation on the other side of the world. Part 2. Spring, 2011 to 2012. Chapter 9. Egypt. The transition must begin now. After we got back from Hawaii, Obama had a call with Hosni Mubarak. Over the previous 3 weeks, the protests in Tunisia had spread like a brush fire. On January 11th, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, the dictator who had ruled Tunisia for decades, fled power. People in Cairo had begun to mimic Bouazizi, setting themselves on fire to protest corruption, repression, and Mubarak. Despite these tremors, the intelligence community did not initially think that the protests were likely to topple other governments. Men like Mubarak and Bashar al-Assad of Syria were too entrenched, able to count on the loyalty of security services and the backing of foreign powers. In the case of Egypt, that power was the United States, which had provided decades of military assistance following the Camp David Accords and forged deep relationships between the Egyptian state and our own national security establishment. I was part of a cohort of younger staffers in the government who shared a distaste for the corrupt way in which the Middle East was ruled. Most of the Foreign Service officers had served there and had friends there who felt no connection to their own governments. The mix of monarchies and autocracies whose legitimacy rested on a family's claim to a piece of land, or militaries who insisted upon a tight-fisted rule to keep an enemy at bay. Islamists, terrorists, Iran. These younger staffers were much more certain of spreading unrest than the more senior people. Meanwhile, a patchwork of aides was pressing for more support for the protesters across the region. Gail Smith, the NSC's senior director for democracy, a flamboyant, white-haired former journalist who had served as an Africa expert under Clinton. Mike McFaul, the NSC's senior director for Russia, who had spent most of his life thinking and writing about democratic movements. And, of course, Samantha Power. "Egypt is next," they'd say, "and will be a test of whether we'd stand on the side of the people in the streets or the autocrats trying to put them down." Obama's call with Mubarak was focused on Middle East peace, but he used it to discuss the protests in Tunisia. "We think it is best if Ben Ali does not return to Tunisia," Obama said. "We hope the Tunisian government will hold free and fair elections in the future." "I think he will not be able to return again," Mubarak responded with confidence. "You will not succeed unless the people are very fair and want you. I told the same thing to Gaddafi." In the days that followed, every television in the West Wing showed silent images of protest, young men running in the streets, masses gathering in Tahrir Square, people the same age as me chanting together and then being dispersed by the same security forces who had guarded our motorcade route in Cairo. Meanwhile, Hillary had insisted the Egyptian government was stable. Biden said in an interview that no, Mubarak wasn't a dictator. We issued mild calls for the government to show restraint in suppressing the protests. We were, it seemed, a step and a half behind the people in the streets, implicitly siding with a dictator in the country where Obama had talked about how democracy was compatible with Islam and the Arab world. Privately, Obama was telling people that his sympathies were with the people. If it were up to him, he told McFaul, he'd prefer that the Google guy run Egypt, referring to Wael Ghanim, a prominent activist who was helping to lead the protest movement. He didn't mean it literally. He was indicating solidarity with the younger protesters trying to bring about change. But his senior team was in a different place. Gates and our military favored stability in Egypt, and they felt that stability came with Mubarak. The Clintons had a long-standing relationship with Mubarak, dating back to the Middle East peace process of the Clinton years. The intelligence community was wary of extremists taking advantage of the unrest. The main driver of opinion seemed to be generational, with the younger staff pressing for change. Mubarak no longer represented stability, we'd say. His dictatorship was the source of instability. This was a once-in-a-generation chance to achieve meaningful reform in the Arab world. We had a moral responsibility to be on the right side of history. It would be a betrayal of what Obama stood for, of what his own election represented, if we weren't. This divide was starkly illustrated for me when Obama gave his first statement on Egypt on the 28th. The protests were now boiling over, and Egypt seemed poised on the precipice between a brutal crackdown and some kind of radical change. The statement I drafted spoke about the universal rights of the protesters and called on the government to respect those rights, refrain from violence, and pursue a path of political change. Tom Donilon and Dennis McDonough asked me to give a copy to each of the principals. The edits that came back took out almost all of this language. One draft illustrated the resistance to change so starkly that I saved it and kept it in my desk for the next 6 years. Every word about human rights and the grievances of the protesters was removed. All that remained were the calls on the protesters to be peaceful and expressions of support for the Egyptian government. Written in the margins was simply the word balance. Obama ended up using the draft I'd written, largely intact. The rhythm of those days was unlike anything I'd experienced before. Anne was traveling, so I'd go home every night around 10, eat on the couch while drinking something stiff, watching cable news, and falling asleep to the scene of crowds swelling. I'd wake and go to work, get my briefing, dominated by stories of unrest in Egypt and surrounding countries, and then attend a standing 8:30 deputies meeting to review what was happening. Before every briefing, Gibbs would complain that we weren't embracing the protests, arguing that our calls on the government to show restraint risked looking ridiculous. One day, as I sat in Gibbs's office, the large, mounted television screen showed government-associated goons on horseback with machetes trying to clear Tahrir Square. "How the fuck am I supposed to call that restraint?" he said. Every meeting seemed consequential. Every statement felt pivotal. People would forward me reports that had been sent to them by their friends who had taken up living in Tahrir Square, quoting verbatim from things that Obama had said, lamenting that he wasn't taking their side. On the other hand, our military and diplomats were getting calls from Egyptian officials expressing anger that Obama was abandoning them. The only thing they had in common is that they seemed to care deeply about what we were saying. And to me, it seemed, there were clear-cut choices between right and wrong, boldness and caution, the past and the future. To those of us who were pushing for change, it was clear that the cabinet-level principles were not. Time and again, Bob Gates, Hillary Clinton, and Mike Mullen would put forward the Egyptian government's view that the protests would die down, that things could be channeled into a national dialogue, that our policy should aim to revert to the status quo. This approach was being pushed hard by the Gulf states, chiefly Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, UAE, who feared this kind of unrest coming to their capitals. On January 29th, Obama got a call from King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia, who complained that our statements were too forward-leaning. In a sign of how closely our words were being watched, he took exception to statements Gibbs had made in his briefings supporting the protesters. He dismissed the people in the street as nothing more than the Muslim Brotherhood, Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda,